This is from the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 2. Chapter 2 in Luke's Gospel begins with the Christmas story, and the chapter closes with this story. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. And after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been looking for you anxiously." And he said to them, "How is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" As a kid, my dad and I had a little game, you know. We'd tussle and roughhouse and knock around the living room, and the game would end when he'd put me in kind of a hammerlock back here, and he'd go, "Who's got the power?" And I'd laugh and say, "I do," and he'd crank it a little bit harder, "Who's got the power?" And after about two or three of the, and, you know, this was not called the CPS type thing. It was just a game, you know. And I said, "Oh, you do, Daddy." And he'd laugh, and that was the end of the game. That's how you end the game. Who's got the power? It's kind of an interesting question. What is power? Sometimes we think of it as authority, which is technically a little different. Ones in authority have the ability to get us to do things we don't want to do. Well, like pay taxes, for example. Don't want to do that. On the other hand, we don't want to buy our own fire truck in school either, but nonetheless. Power is a little bit different. Power is the ability to set a goal and achieve it. Now, that has a lot to do with what resources we have at hand. So I'm going to give you the answer to the question, who's got the power, right out of the box. God has the power. The church has the power. You and I have the power to set goals and achieve them. Now, the question is, what's the goal? God's goal is really remarkably simple. God wants us back. We left. We were separated from God. The New Old Testament tells the story as the Garden of Eden. Mythology tells it as Pandora's box. Same story. Somehow, after God created a perfect world and put human beings in it, human beings fled, left, became separated. Now, theologically, that is the really most profound and honestly the only definition of sin. We think of sin as actions, things we do that we shouldn't, things that we don't do that we should, things that we would try to prevent. Sin is less about activity than it is about a condition. Properly understood in its full biblical theology, sin is separation. It's a condition of being estranged. God's business is bringing us back together. He tried several ways in the Old Testament, plagues and exile and all manners of things, until finally he brings us back together through the once and for all atoning sacrifice of Jesus. Now, in the meantime, we are to be about his Father's business. God has the power to bring us back together. And for reasons that we'll have to find out fully when it is our time to find such things out, he's sort of using us to make that message known. He's asking us to act as though it were true that we belong together. God has the power to make that happen. The church has the power to make it visible, which, quite frankly, is a tough sell these days. Struck this week, and several commentators made the point, that the cultural and social and political reaction to 9/11, similar to the cultural, political, and social reaction to the Kennedy assassination, the Oklahoma City bombing, Pearl Harbor, was to draw us together, to make us more aware of the things that unite us and backload the things that divide us. In the week since Orlando, not so much. The rhetoric of, on both sides, I might add, the rhetoric about guns and gays and Islam, radical and otherwise, has created a level of tension and dissension different than what I remember from 9/11 and Oklahoma City and even the Kennedy assassination. Different also, I might add, and one commentator pointed this out, to the reaction in Great Britain just this last Thursday to the assassination of a member of parliament, a member of the opposition party to Prime Minister David Cameron, a political enemy, was lost to insane gunfire. And David Cameron and Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition party, stood side by side to honor and pay respect in memory of Joe Cox. Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron viscerally despise each other. And yet, for just a second, the bridge was built. How do we do that? Who's got the power to make that happen around here? We do. We have a secret. We have the sacrament of belonging, the sacrament of holy baptism. We have baptism over at the Presbyterian Church today. Taylor Graves, who's little Bella Graves' mom, is going to be baptized. She works for Wells Fargo. And she said a couple months ago, I'd like for that to happen. And I said, great. You got to pass. No, you don't have to pass the test. You just have to want it, because we want you. We want you in the club. We want you in the group. And why do we do that? It's interesting to me to note that the story of Jesus in the temple occurs only in Luke's gospel. And it's only in Luke's gospel where Jesus says he must be about his Father's business early on. And then for the rest of the gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, which is Luke's second book about the apostles, Luke takes special care to send the message that his Father's business is about being inclusive. Luke's gospel is the only gospel where we have the Good Samaritan story. It's the only gospel where we have Zacchaeus, the tax collector, up a tree. The book of Acts has a couple of fascinating instances where, you know, you'd think unbaptizable people wind up getting baptized. Cornelius, a member of the Roman army, a member of the occupying force, is baptized by Peter, who says, truly I say, God shows no partiality. An Ethiopian eunuch, African, probably darker skinned eunuch, says, what's to prevent me from being baptized? And the Apostle Philip says, nothing is to prevent you. Come down. Who gets to be in the group? Anybody that wants to, anybody that's got something to offer. The whole flap about gay ordination and gay marriage has been going on for a lot longer, at least inside the church, than has been on the front pages of newspapers and so on. I was in seminary nearly 40 years ago. I overheard a conversation between a seminarian and a professor, and the seminarian said, well, should we ordain gay men and lesbian women? And the professor said, I don't know, would you baptize a gay man or a lesbian woman? And the seminarian said, yeah. And the professor said, you've just answered your own question. Because all vocation is rooted in baptism. Ordination is just one office to which some are called. But some are also called to be teachers and accountants and ranchers and name your job. All are called to be who they are where who they are needs to be. It all starts with baptism. And who gets to be in the club? Anybody that wants to be of use. It's our job to help them to be useful, to build that bridge between who people are, to nurture them and develop what they can do, and to find a place where they can do that for the well-being of all of us. In other words, to be about our Father's business. We have the power to do that. By water and the Spirit and by the laying on of hands with prayer, Taylor Alicia Graves today is sent forth to be who she is, to do what she does, to be about her Father's business. God has the power to close the gap. We have the power to make it real as the church. And you and I have the power to make it matter to us. We have the power to develop the wit and the will to bring it about. Jeannie and I were at the South Plains Food Bank annual gathering of mobile pantry leaders and other volunteers and people that are about the business of feeding the hungry. And at lunch, which was really a good lunch, by the way, David Weaver, the executive director of the food bank, was the keynote speaker, which you'd expect. And I've heard David Weaver speak many times, actually, and heard much of what he had to say as he was saying it before, thanking the volunteers, talking about the new building, talking about what the food bank can do in terms of meals, and then telling a couple of stories. And I have given speeches that I've given before, and before and before and before. We call them lectures in class. So I know that essentially this is David Weaver's stump speech, right? And in this speech, he told a story that had happened some 25 plus years ago when he was newly involved with the food bank. And it was about a woman who he named. And the details of the story are irrelevant, except that this woman was a piece of work and pretty annoying. And when she called or when she came by, David said that his instinct was to be on the phone or be in another room, and it never worked, et cetera, et cetera. And then he told the story, and again, the details don't matter, of how this woman and he, oddly and in ways that you would not expect, connected emotionally. And as David Weaver told that story, he began to weep. Not sobbing, but you get it. And I'm thinking, he's told this story 100 times. This is part of his stump speech. He's doing it on purpose to show us how deeply connected both he is in his work to doing his Father's business. That was as much a part of the speech, his reaction to his own story that he's told 100 times, which he was not acting. I was touched. So I asked myself, what does it mean to be about our Father's business? And who's got the power? Well, God is about the business of filling in the separation of sin. We are about the business of building those bridges one with another. And we get the energy to do that when we connect with the people who touch us emotionally, the people who love us, the people who pick us up when we ourselves have fallen and failed, the people with whom we have last wept. My dad was the best man at Jeannie's and my wedding almost 16 years ago. And he was the best man because he is the best man I know. He's not the most intelligent or creative or capable or he's not going to win the Nobel Prize, and neither am I. But he is truly the best man I know. And he's the best man I know because he is decent, he is honest, he is kind, and he is generous. And I think fundamental decency, kindness, honesty, and generosity are character traits that grow and develop as we are touched, as we build bridges, as we are about our Father's business, because we have the power.